I have observed that people come to church just like many of you and I came today for a variety of reasons. You know, sometimes it's to celebrate. That's a good reason to go to church. People come to celebrate. I was at a wedding yesterday, officiated at a wedding. Like most weddings, they're filled with kind of a common sentiment, this sense of wonder and awe as the woman in white walks down the aisle and greets the groom, and it's a wonderful place, and it's truly appropriate time to celebrate. Some people do, in fact, come to church for those reasons. Others come to be challenged. You take a look at your life. You hear things that stir inside and make you rethink, what is it that drives my life? What are the priorities of my life? And sometimes you're stopped right in your tracks, and it makes you really wonder at a very personal level for you, has he truly come to have first place in every part of my life, like Colossians chapter 1 talks about? Sometimes it stops you, and sometimes it causes you to be challenged and even change. Still others come to church, and a big part of it for you is you look forward to and long to hear something from God, and that's an appropriate desire, an appropriate reason to gather, to be taught from God's Word, and to do what we just did, worship the one that we're learning about in His Word. That's a good reason to come. Still others come to church for comfort. They grieve losses that hit hard and hold on, it seems like, in this life. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Southern Cal to officiate at a memorial service of a wonderful, wonderful woman. She was this lady that just wanted to be known as a woman that prayed and a woman that loved Jesus enough to talk about Him to people. That's it. That was the summary of her life. And her prayers were part of what God answered to bring children into our life, so into Debbie's and my life. So she was a wonderful lady. And I remember midway point through the things that I had to share, quoting that wonderful Psalm 115, verse 16, which says, "Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of a godly one." And I remember thinking at that time, you know, it's precious in your sight, God. We believe it. You say so in your word. And we have to imagine in our mind just how precious it is for you to have this dear saint home with you. But I got to tell you, it stinks for the rest of us. It really doesn't feel good. It's a constant sense of sadness and sorrow. She knew Jesus, and her family, also knew Jesus, and there's a wonderful day yet in the future where they will be reunited, but it's pretty hard if you stay and cope with this immeasurable loss that you feel. On a given week, folks come to this church feeling similar ways. The lobby on a given Sunday, we have a variety of people, not all of which this story describes them, but some have said to me, "You know what, Pastor? Is it okay if I sit in the lobby? Because I got such a hurt and such a heaviness and such a sadness going down in my life. I just think I would come unglued if I tried to come into the main worship area." And I'm like, "Please. Sit wherever it is that God has you sit to experience and encounter Him." But I read just this past week 4 pages of people pleading with God, crying out to God, saying, "God, I'm coming to you again for comfort." And many of those people are you who turn in zip strips and prayer requests and you're pouring out your heart. In fact, indeed, some of you are here this morning just this side of tears, because you're saying, "I just can't pull it off on my own." Maybe you're a parent of a troubled teenager, and you know you've tried everything, but at this point, it's up to God. You are powerless to affect the outcome. And so you cry out to God, and that's a good reason to come to church, because you're directed to a God that cares about you and cares about that hurt in your heart. Or maybe some of you come because you're in a work situation that's, you live under a tyranny of an impossible boss. And you know, we laugh about that kid, but that's 8 or 10 hours of every day for you. It's no fun at all anymore. But you got this constant sort of must-do kind of mandate on your life because you got to put bread and milk and food on the table. So what do? It's like, God, get me out of this. I can't, I don't know how to go on. Which is similar to those among us who face financial strain and it's not getting better. And you come here near the break point saying, God, help me. God, work this thing out. I come to you because I need comfort in my situation. Maybe you're in a marriage that's just not going to make it. You tried everything. Your spouse isn't willing to meet you there to work on it at the same time, and it's not going to work. And so you come saying, God, I'm broken. I'm beaten down. Or maybe some kind of dreaded disease that is not disappearing. And I know that because, as I mentioned, I read weekly the prayer requests. And many do in our church. Staff and leaders that cry out to God on your behalf. I want to say something to you. If I've touched on a situation you're facing or someone you know, listen to these words. You have made a good choice to come to church. You say, well, of course you're going to say that, Pastor. No, it's not about me and it's not about this church. It's about what you're going to find at church. Why do I say that? When the day is dark and when your week becomes dark and it continues on into the next week and next month and beyond, and it's darkness all around you, and you lift your eyes, and that's our purpose. That's how we plan and pray and prepare for every Sunday, that as people lift their eyes from darkness in their life, they will see and say with Isaiah the prophet, I see Jesus seated on his throne. You may be living darkness, you may leave here and there's still darkness, but when you lift your eyes, you will agree with those words from Isaiah. Let me show you something this morning that helped me immensely in some darkness this past week, just as I think and hope it'll help you in darkness that may be going on in your life or your family or around you. Find your way, if you have a Bible, turn to Isaiah chapter 6. If you don't, would you reach for the Bible that's tucked away in a chair near you? It's fine to do so, and find your way to page 487, and you will be open to this section of Judah's first prophet, Isaiah. While you're on your way there, let me set the scene. The year is 793 BC. Doesn't matter a lot to you or to me, but you're going to read about a guy that has just recently died. He's a pretty special king. His name's King Uzziah. He was also known as King Azariah. And he had died. And he was a highly honored and venerated king. Venerated means, for some of you younger ones that are learning vocabulary, it means he was the kind of king that was appreciated by everybody for good reason. He was a good guy. This King Uzziah, you need to know a couple of things about him. He reigned for 52 years. That's more than a half a century. The other piece that will reach out to you young people, middle schoolers and high schoolers, and absolutely pull you right out of your seat, he was 16 years old when he took the throne. So if you've said to yourself, you know, I don't really come into my own. I don't really have a calling, a mission. God can't really use the likes of me until I get through high school or past college and get into my 20s or married or into my career. Let me just say something to you in Greek nonsense. That's crazy. For you to pass on the possibility that God might be saying something to you who are 12 and 14 and Uzziah 16 years old. He was a profound leader of Judah. The nation's divided. Israel's to the north, Judah's to the south, and Jerusalem was the headquarters or the capital, if you will, of the south. He led Judah in peace and prosperity. 16, didn't even, just barely got his driver's license, right? mean, this guy's young, and great advancements and great achievements occurred under Uzziah's 52 years as the king. Now, you need to know something else, too. Uzziah was so successful, so powerful, that it led to his downfall in his later years. His power led to his pride, which led to his wipeout. It happened in a church gathering, if you will, a temple setting. And Uzziah, he had game. He had it all going. He was hitting on all cylinders. He could make things happen. And in fact, took that attitude with him, which was dangerously teetering on the edge of sin, and took it with him into the temple. And the story is told in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles of his last years of life, where he went into the temple and said, "You know something? You priests, you're not that big a deal. I can do what you're doing. I'll bet I can do it even better than you." And he took some incense and did some offering, and at that moment, the priests, 80 of them in total, shuddered at what they were watching happen. This man, this great king, this mighty man of God was imploding right in front of him. Indeed, the final years of his life, he lived outside of the community of the nation all by himself, terribly lonely man afflicted with leprosy from that point to the end of his life. Because he stumbled near the end. His pride had led to his downfall. Now, though this nation had prospered economically, It was a covering, really, for the spiritual emptiness that encircled its people. I stop right now just to tell you it's pretty obvious the other nation I'm thinking about. Our country has prospered enormously in so many, many ways. But could it be said of us too? It's just a covering. It's just a veneer of spiritual emptiness that encircles many people in our land. But get this about God, and you're going to read this in a minute as we enter into this. God was about to address that very condition. And I'm not convinced he just had it for them in 793 BC. I'm convinced it's stuff he wants us to take and live out today. And the setting that he chose to speak these things was like this setting. It was a gathering place for the people of God. In that day, the temple. Today, the church. And the servant he chose was Isaiah the prophet. And this is how it went. Look on at verse 1 in chapter 6. "In the year that King Uzziah died," he's speaking in first person here, "I saw the Lord." So Isaiah is talking about his own experience here. "I saw the Lord seated on his throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, angels, each with six wings." I've tried to imagine what this looks like. I can't wait to see him when I get to heaven someday. "But they each had six wings. Two wings were used to cover their faces," which is what you do in the presence and in the full view of God. You cover your face. "And then two of them were used to cover their feet," a symbol of humility. "And then with two they were flying about, and as they flew, they called out to one another, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of His glory.' At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and the threshold shook, and the temple was filled with smoke." Isaiah saw the Lord. His outlook up to this point was terribly bleak. The nation was coming apart at the seams. In addition to that, there was the personal pain of loss. He loved this king, and he's gone. And the king faltered at the end, and that had to rip hard at his heart. It all seemed so bleak and so dark. The nation was in peril. And on top of all that, here's Isaiah, this prophet, who felt powerless to do anything about it. So he comes, imagine him now, entering the temple of God on this dark day. He comes into the temple of God and he lifts his eyes to see God seated still on his throne. He followed this wise counsel I read about this week. When the outlook is bleak, try the uplook. Try the uplook. Isaiah did that very thing. And folks, so must you and me. When the outlook is dark, the uplook can be bright. That's what Isaiah was discovering. And some of us need to do that today for this exact reason. Your outlook right now, whatever reason, is bleak. So do what Isaiah did. Try the uplook. And you may even start to see, as he says in verse 3, the whole earth. You might even actually start to see when you lift up from the dark outlook to this uplook, you might actually see the whole earth is full of his glory. I see him. I see God, just as Isaiah would say. Some of us, though, aren't seeing much glory today. And neither did he. But that all changed when he looked up. As Isaiah saw the Lord, I want you to notice something next, because it happens this way still. And it's what you can likely expect to happen for you. When you're bleak, your outlook is bleak, your uplook is bright. And then at that moment, some very dramatic things happen to him. Look on in verse 5 and see for yourself. After coming in here with a bleak and heavy heart, he looks up and he sees God. And at that very moment, he says what is so common to people who have this encounter. Woe to me, verse 5. I cried, I'm ruined. I'm a man of unclean lips. I live among a people that are just like me. My eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. Then one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and he said, see, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for. Can't you just feel the lift? Don't you, when you read those words, just say, can you imagine the living God looking at you and saying your outlook was bleak, you took it to an uplook, and at that moment you were acutely aware of your own sin. You felt dirty, you felt filthy, you felt terribly inappropriate to be in that place. And then he makes this kind of move, and he says to you words that set you free. Your guilt is taken away. Why? Because I've touched you. And with it, your sins have been covered or atoned for. Isaiah saw the Lord, and Isaiah now sees himself. Something supernatural happens to Isaiah at this moment. His sin is something he can no longer ignore. It stands out. And Isaiah's unholiness, his unholy self, becomes completely obvious and conspicuous in the presence of holy God. So unsettling was this image of himself that Isaiah cried out for some kind of intervention. God, do something. I feel so unworthy. So he cries out, woe to me. I'm unclean, and there's not one of us that is clean. You need to understand something. What you're reading and what I am reading here and developing for us is not just about Isaiah's experience in chapter 6 in the year 739 when King Uzziah died. It is a well-worn, familiar pattern of people in the Bible and today as well. You can go page to page through your Bible. When a person is in the presence of the Lord, he or she senses their own sin and their own unworthiness. That needs to happen to us. And if you look up and if you see the Lord, that is in fact what will happen. And I want you to see and understand something now. Notice that in grace, God does not scold, God does not condemn, and God does not destroy the prophet. But instead, what does he do? He touches him, and he cleans him, and he restores him. That's huge. That's why the word is grace. You'd expect him at that moment to get fried. You'd expect him at that moment, because he's in the presence of Almighty Holy God, to be toast. God would have nothing to do with that. He touches and he cleanses him and he restores him. God did what only God can do and what every person who encounters God desperately needs for God to do. To forgive him, and I'll repeat the words again, take away his guilt because his sin is atoned for. You know, I've been fascinated this week about that concept of God lifting guilt from sinners. As I've been saying, it's not just unique to Isaiah. It's what David described when he looked back on his adultery with Bathsheba and the murder to cover his tracks. He says, when he confessed his sin and God did the work of forgiveness to touch him and to cleanse him and to restore him, he says the same words in Psalm 32, verse 5, you remove the guilt of my sin. Over in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 2, he says, the reason Jesus came, the reason the final and ultimate sacrifice, Jesus Christ came, was so that he could do the work of forgiveness in people that desperately needed forgiveness, and that in doing that work of forgiveness, he could lift the guilt of their sin. You see, what God does here is he comes to a person who is guilty, and by forgiving them as they confess their sin to the Holy God, God says, I am setting you free from this burden and weight and bondage of guilt. That's huge. You and I cannot possibly imagine all the implications of that. I want to tell you a true story that's going on right now at home. It's a big drama in my front yard. We're planting a lawn. I killed the first lawn with Roundup. I had a lot of fun. I love Roundup. It's a very special way to watch a lawn that was ugly and weed. It was awful, and so I killed it. I thought, okay, have it your way. Bye, you know, and killed the lawn and then went to all this trouble to plant a new lawn. And I was told, whatever you do, make sure you dump tons of seed. I mean, overseeded and overseeded. I did a lot of seed in the front lawn. And then I took this stuff called topper. And topper is supposed to be spread out to keep the birds from eating all your seed. Everybody with me? Well, I was told, and if you have birds, lots of birds in your yard, you'll want to use more topper. And Debbie loves birds. She has bird feeders and bird things that say, everybody, come here. Come join us and enjoy yourself in our yard. And I'm thinking, no. Trevor, you got that BB gun? We may need it. You know, that kind of thing. And so we've got this topper. And I put it on a little thick. Well, guess what's happening now? The lawn, I went out the other day, 2 days ago, and I went out and thinking, Lord, you know what? I don't see grass growing. It's like day six, and I have not seen any green. I'm thinking, this is not good, you know. And my neighbors are going, hey, didn't you plant that like a week ago? And I'm like, yeah, shut up, you know. And then they and then they throw in, hey, you know, I said, well, you know, I'm just kind of trying to talk into it a little bit, you know, tried to make fun of the situation. They go, oh, ye of little faith. And I'm like, what is this about, you know? And guess what? It starts to come up through. But you notice what I was noticing yesterday? There are big sections of it where I'm looking down and it looks like moles or gophers are starting to poke up. I don't have any of those. What it is all this grass growing under this heavy weight of the topper. And it's like this grass is going, help us. We're trying to grow, but we've got this awful load that we're trying to poke our way through. So I'm thinking, okay, I'll be right back. And I run in the shed and get a rake and I'm tapping down, trying not to walk out in it, so I'm poking little holes, like breathing holes for my precious lawn, and guess what happened? Almost instantly, this grass went like that. Almost the moment I poked these holes to break through this kind of mass of burden and weight on my grass, these little lovelies just poked their way through, and now the lawn's a foot and a half tall. In 3 days, baby. It's a great lawn. You know what I'm saying? You do know what I'm saying. Because you know what it's like to be laid low and weighed down with guilt. With all that comes by the bleak outlook. You come bondage and burdened and broken down, and God says, you know what? I am going to set you free. And the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to lift that load. As you've confessed your sin to me, I will forgive you. Contrary to what some people say, no, you've messed up, to hell with you. God says, no way, I've gone there for you. In the person of my Son, who died on that cross for you. So I can take that load of guilt and shame, and I can clean you. Can I tell you what happens next? You probably already read verse 8. You could preach this last point. Incredible moment happens. Isaiah sees the Lord, and Isaiah sees his own sin. Isaiah's renewal wasn't complete by any means at this point. It wasn't enough for Isaiah to turn his outlook to an uplook. God was going to give him a brand new outlook. You read it in verse 8, it's just one verse. Then I heard the voice of the Lord, Isaiah says, the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? A reference to the Trinity. And I said, here I am. Send me. The very guy that didn't feel like I belonged a few minutes ago. But because of your touch in my life, send me. People, this is the pattern of God in people he uses. You realize that? It's really true. He will first do the work in you before he can do the work through you. It's just how it works. To put a verse to it, before he gives us the job of pointing out with trembling the woe in others, that's verse 8, before he sends us on that mission, he does the hardest work in verse 5, pointing out the woe in self. That's the part most people I know would rather skip over. But that's not God's pattern for our lives. So Isaiah was surprised, to say the least. He came to the house of the Lord to be comforted. He had a lot of burden on his heart. He was weighed down. And his outlook was bleak. His need drove him there. But he got way more than comfort, didn't he? He turned his outlook to an uplook. And in doing so, it caused him to come under conviction of his sin. And when forgiven and changed, God gave him a commission to go and tell what God had done to Isaiah when God did the uplook. You know, he follows the same pattern today. I am absolutely convinced. In fact, I'm going to be so bold as to say some of you came here for comfort. And you're hearing a different message than you expected. Be assured that God will, intends to, and desires to apply the same comfort to your heart. But in doing so, he will likely expose sin. And in exposing sin, he wants to hear from you, God, I did it. I'm here to confess my sin. Those three words, woe is me. And when he hears those words from us, he will cleanse at that moment. Touch you as he did Isaiah. And then he will commission you to go from here and tell the story of what just happened to you. And when you do, don't stutter. I'd like you to bow your heads with me for a moment. We're going to share in communion. Communion's meant to stop us in our tracks as we look. And the song we sang earlier is a very good way for us to remember what this table's all about. I'm forgiven. but it came at the cost of you being forsaken, Lord. And this morning I want to invite you to respond to His Holy Spirit. You may have come here with a burden that makes your outlook very bleak, but you have raised your view. You've lifted your eyes and seen Him seated on His throne. And now the next move is yours. Are you coming to terms with your sin? I don't know what it might be. I can't possibly answer that question for anybody. I have a lot to think through of my own. What is it that He wants to touch in my life to cleanse me from, so that He can send me, so that He can commission me to go for Him? So in these moments, as servers will bring the bread and then the cup, we'll take a few moments to think about communion. I want to invite you. Some of you may do this right where you're seated, and that's just fine. Where you go from a bleak outlook and you lift up your eyes, you physically lift up your eyes and imagine Jesus seated on His throne. And at that moment, say to Him, Lord, what is woe in me? And I ask You to deal with that right now. Some of you are not going to want to stay seated for very long. You're going to want to make your way up front as they did first hour and just kneel down at the front. That'll be just fine. Servers will bring the plates back to the front at the end and serve you as well. Will you do that? My Father, when my soul wants to swallow me in its dark, when I forget all You've done and look only at what You seem to have left undone, forgive me, God. And open my eyes of faith to look up to Your great and good and unfailing gift of love itself. This table reminds us that You are the giver of life. You're the bread of life that's new fallen from heaven every morning for me. In this moment, in this time of quietness, speak to my heart. Lead me to a place where my guilt lifts as my heart is forgiven. Do that as You hear me confess to You right now. God, you're the bread of life. You sent Jesus to come to people that you had every right to care nothing for. But you sent him to sacrifice himself for us so that you could achieve things we would never be capable of on our own. We take this bread now to remember the bread of life, your Son. the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Your great desire for our hearts today, God, is to lift the load that has made our outlook bleak. And as you lift it by cleansing us from within, you show us a view of yourself that you truly are. As we do the uplook, we see you on your throne. We see you in control. And we take refuge in you as we go. As we leave this place, put on our hearts a profound testimony, a story of truth about how you've touched us. We came in burdened and beaten down, and we left lifted because of you, because we've come here for you. And you've changed us in the result. So we take this cup to remember that we've been forgiven because you were forsaken as you poured out your life to cover our sin. So we worship you, Jesus, in taking this.